come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my good friend Benjamin Alida Sines and I are going to be talking to fiction writer Ksenia Melnick, and we're going to be talking about her new book, Snow in May, which is a fantastic collection of stories set in a small town in Russia where it's really, really cold, most of the stories during the Soviet Union. And for Poem of the Week, Samuel Calvin Brown is going to read a poem by Dylan Thomas, which seems appropriate because Ksenia's book, Snow in May, was recently shortlisted for the Dylan Thomas Prize, which is a really big ado. So stick around. It's going to be a fantastic show. Have you ever bought a book at a bookstore, a brand new book? You look at the front cover, you look at the back cover, you look at the first few lines, and you say, this is going to be an amazing book. You even smell it because you love the smell of new books. I think the only thing that smells better than a new book is an old book. Smelling an old book is like, I don't know, breathing in the breath of a ghost. But anyway, you buy the book, you take it home, you put it on your coffee table, and you say, I am going to read this baby tonight. So you make dinner or whatever it is you do when you get home. You watch the news, light up the crack pipe, whatever. But it's evening and then night and then time passes. And then maybe you watch a little bit of TV and you look at that book and you realize that you're too tired to read it that night. Or you realize that you haven't finished the book you started last week. So you say, as soon as I'm done, I'm starting on that new book. But then days pass and then weeks pass. And then one day you take the book off the coffee table and you put it on a bookshelf and say, well, I'm going to get to that. I'm going to get to it. But then months pass and you forget about it. And sometimes even years pass and you buy other books and you're excited to get them and you put them on the coffee table and you say, I'm going to read this one tonight. And probably sometimes you actually do buy a book and read it immediately. But let's face it. This happens. You buy a book, you put it on the shelf, and you forget about it. But I believe that books are like souls. Books are living souls. And that soul, even though it's on the shelf, is waiting for you. It's waiting for your soul to connect to its soul. But it's just not the time. Now, if you buy a book and you don't read it, this might be why. Say your life, you know, seems to be going in the wrong direction. You're sad. Maybe you're depressed. You know, maybe you thought you kicked the hell out of depression after reading Eckhart Tolle, but maybe a loved one died or you didn't get the job you wanted, or in my case, the price of wine went up, whatever. So one day, feeling really bad, you look through your bookshelf and you're not really looking for something, but you're looking for something. And there it is. That new book you bought years ago. You pick it up, you look at the front and back, and you don't even remember when you bought it. It must have been years ago. But you sit down with the book, you open it up, and you start reading, and here's the crazy thing. It's exactly what you need to read at that time. It speaks directly to your soul what you need at that moment. Does this ever happen to you? Because this happens to me all the time. It's as if the book knew when you needed to read it. It's, well, like we say at the end of the show, it's as if a book could save your life. Because I believe that when you pick up a book, like for example, when you go to the bookstore here in El Paso or whatever city you're in and you buy Ksenia Melnick's Snow in May, even if you don't get to it right away, your soul will know exactly the right time to read that book. Your soul knows you're going to need every book that you buy. It's not a waste to buy books, even if you don't get to it at the exact moment when you buy it. That's how amazing books are. They speak to our souls, and that's why we love them. And I know you're going to love Snow in May. So stick around, and Benjamin Alida Sines and I are going to talk to fiction writer Ksenia Melnick, author of Snow in May. Ksenia Melnick's debut book is the linked short story collection Snow in May, which was shortlisted for the International Dylan Thomas Prize and longlisted for the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. Born in Magadan, Russia, she moved to Alaska in 1998 at the age of 15. And so you know exactly how old she is if you know the math. She received her MFA from NYU, and her work has appeared in the Brooklyn Rail, the Virginia Quarterly Review, and many, many more. And she lives in El Paso, Texas. So she's going to be in the studio talking to me and Ben. Ksenia, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're not from here, are you?
I'm sure from a long place away from here.
Tell us a little bit about your background, a little bit about the book Snow in May, which I just finished reading. I think it's just fantastic.
Thanks so much. Well, yes. So I was born in Magadan, Russia, which is a small, isolated town in the northeast of Russia. Sort of if you look at the map, you know, find Alaska first and then go to the left of that. And that part of Russia is the northeast. And Magadan is on the
coast. It's the part of Russia that Sarah Palin can see from her
front
yard.
Well, supposedly. But you know what? I can see Mexico from here, and I'm not lying. Where she is one of the things that she's lying about. Anyway, we won't get political. But so that's where I'm from. And my dad worked in airlines, and he started, when the Iron Curtain went up, he started sort of helping organize flights to Alaska and Seattle, I think, at some point. And he started working in Anchorage, and we moved to Anchorage permanently when I was 15. And I lived there for a couple of years, and I went to school upstate New York, and then I lived in New York City for a while, and I went back to Alaska, lived there for a few years. And now I'm here.
Well, you know, you're very modest. You say you went to New York for a while. You got your MFA at NYU, which is really a fantastic program.
Yeah, it was amazing. I got my undergrad at Colgate University, which is upstate, which I didn't know how far that was from New York City. I was like, I'm going to New York. And then I went to Colgate, and it was like 6 hours by car and no trains. So I had to wait another 4 years. But to live in New York has always been my dream. And then after 6 years in New York, just working various jobs, thinking, am I going to go to law school? Am I going to go to medical school? Or am I going to just commit to being like a poor writer, you know? Yeah, I got my MFA at NYU. And then after I finished it, I just needed sort of some time away from there to finish my book. But then, of course, it took years more.
You went from one dream to another, from New York City to El Paso, Texas. Let's talk about Snow in May. This is a fantastic book, and it all mostly takes place in your town, Magadan, which is, you describe in some interviews as the gateway to the Siberian experience or something.
Well, Magadan has a very interesting history. And let me just tell you that I didn't know that much of it when I lived there. So there were just kind of some rumors, some references in the air between the adults talking. But I didn't pick up on quite what kind of dark history it has. It started out as a gold rush town, you know, people going there to prospect for gold in very small numbers. And then once the Soviet Union found out just how rich in gold and tin and just all sorts of natural resources it is, it jumped and created this organization that was going to, you know, develop it. And of course, nobody wants to go there because how far and cold and just hard it was to live there back in the 30s. And so they organized, it was part of a big network of gulag forced labor camps. And so from the 30s to, you know, to almost late 50s, it was sort of known a place where one of the cruelest networks of camps, just because of the environment. So a lot of people went there from all sorts of walks of life. A lot of people died there, and a lot of people were executed there, you know, during the terror years. But then when that was over, it became this town where people actually wanted to come because they paid much higher salaries there than on the mainland. Well, you know, we call it the mainland. You know, Magadan is not an island, but it might as well be, just because they needed to entice people to come and work there. And young people came, and it became a very thriving town in the 60s and 70s. My grandfather came there in the late 50s to work. My dad grew up there, and they had amazing theaters and libraries and schools and music programs, had a lot of educated people there. So it was kind of unique in the sense just how isolated it was, you know, from the European part of Russia. And then in the 90s, the USSR fell and those subsidies ended and there was a big exodus from Magadan and the population just crashed and it was very hard there in the 90s. And by then we were immigrating to Alaska, so I didn't experience as much hardship as some other people. But when I started...
Like your characters, they experience a lot of hardship.
Oh, yeah. Collection. Well, I really had to imagine myself, like, what it'd be like to live there as an adult and have responsibility because my childhood was very happy, you know?
Right.
But yeah, then I started writing about it in college and after college and started researching that. And I was like, holy crap, like, that is, I had no idea what kind of town I was from.
How hard was it to write this book?
Well, so it took me, I want to say almost 10 years. The first story, Krichina, the oldest story, I started out as a short screenplay in 2004. I think 2004 or 2005. So from that to publication, that's 10 years. Of course, I wrote a lot of stuff in between, but it was just a matter of kind of coming to terms with it, learning to write, doing the research, and then figuring out how to write about that kind of material, you know, looking for my voice. But at the same time, while there are some autobiographical parts, a lot of it is not autobiographical. So I had to also just grow up myself to try to imagine what it would be like if I lived there as an adult, you know.
You describe in incredible detail life in the Soviet Union mm-hmm. and throughout about three decades or so.
From late 50s to 90s.
Yeah.
So.
And, mm-hmm. When you lived there, you left when you were 15. Mm-hmm. I assume that the Soviet Union had already fallen
before
you left. So you didn't mm-hmm. actually live under Soviet rule or remember living under Soviet rule?
Well, I remember going to kindergarten, singing, you know, those pioneer songs. there was a picture of Lenin in a lot of textbooks and just a lot of even children's books. You know, Lenin lives. Lenin will always live. Some of those poems. I remember seeing that. And then when I was in primary school, I joined like the first stage kind of on your way to the Communist Party is the young Octoberists, and that's for little kids, and mm-hmm. then you become a pioneer, and then you become a Komsomol.
Sounds like the Boy Scouts.
It's just with the right. Party lines sort of weaved in a little bit. So I had my little Lenin pin, you know, but of course you don't really know what it's about.
Right,
you're like, oh.
The way you describe it is at times heartbreaking. I'm thinking particularly of the first story, which is called Love Italian Style or In Line for Bananas.
Mm-hmm.
There's this beautiful moment where the main character who, rather than giving in to her desires, and I won't say exactly what they are, I think mm-hmm. the readers should experience it themselves, decides instead to stand in line for bananas so she could bring them home to her kids because bananas are such a rare thing. And it's just heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking what happens to her, the bananas, and everything like that. But are these stories you heard about waiting in lines and all the scarcity of products? And
well, I remember the shops when they were full of sort of Soviet products, but I also remember the shops when they were empty and standing in line. And actually, they were kind of rations in the sense that you were only allowed to get, during the lean times, you could only get a certain amount of certain products per family member. So I definitely remember standing in line with dad, for example, and then we would call and my mom would come and bring, you know, my baby sister just to show them we had four people in our family. And so I remember standing in line. It's always a stressful experience because people always shove and sort of, you know, try to force you out. But that story, living in Magadan, I remember whenever my parents went anywhere, they always brought gifts and especially just warm clothes. Mm. And that was always such a big deal and like a little holiday. I mean, I always make this joke. It's just not comparable to going to Walmart and buying something or receiving that pair of boots that's like a really good real leather, real fur boots that are too big for you and you're going to grow into and just how you treasure those things. And if God forbid you lose them, that's just tragedy. But my parents definitely, I mean, I didn't experience what my character experienced, but I've heard my dad just as a pack mule returning from Moscow to Magadan and just bringing all those fruits and vegetables and snow clothes and things like that. So
let me ask you something on a different note. Mm-hmm. How hard was it for you, because English isn't your first language, mm-hmm. how hard is it for you to write in English? Or is it just come naturally to you by now?
Well, I think at this point, writing and speaking in English for me is easier than writing and speaking in Russian. Though I still read Russian literature in Russian, and I talk to my parents in Russian, though they would tell you not very well. yeah. But I started learning English in second grade in Russian school. So, and we had a very good English program in school. So it's been a while that I've been learning and practicing. So by now...
So that wasn't an issue when you wrote the English thing?
I don't know. I think in the beginning, 10 years ago, it was an issue in college, where I just wanted to write something that a person could read without kind of stumbling over sentences. But I think now I'm trying to recreate certain Russian cadences in my writing, especially if a person is speaking in Russian, but it's in English. Or if it's an immigrant speaking in bad English, like I think how I can portray that so that the person can tell. It's not just me kind of writing in bad English.
You do what us Chicanos do a lot. You code switch. You use a lot of Russian words, like babushka is always in there.
Yeah.
Which means an older woman, right?
It means grandmother. It does not mean a shawl, yeah. But maybe it does, but it always just annoys me. Like, she was wearing a babushka. I was like, no.
That's fantastic.
You know?
Have you ever read Bernard Malamud's A Man in the Drawer, The Man in the Drawer?
I don't think I have.
Oh, it's a wonderful story. It's about this man who goes to the Soviet Union, a writer, and there's a Russian writer who gives him a manuscript and says, please help me get this published. And in the Bernard Malamud fashion, he talks about each story. But it kind of reminded me of your last story, Our Upstairs Neighbor, mm-hmm. in that you have this incredibly popular and talented and apparently brilliant musician. And the story is about him, but it's not about him. He never actually appears on the page. It's mm-hmm. the narrator's story. Really, that parallels his mm-hmm. narrative. Can you talk a little bit about that story, how it came about? And is that singer who in the, what's his name, Malcolm?
Okay, so in my story, his name is Vadim Makin, but he is based on a real person, Vadim Kozin. And so he was somebody who was a very famous, he was like the Frank Sinatra of Russia in the 20s, 30s, 40s, very, very popular. And then he got arrested, and there are still rumors as to why, whether he became a little too popular for Stalin's liking, you know, because, you know, Stalin wanted to be the favorite.
Stalin was a star.
Also, whether he was homosexual, which is also, I think I've heard he denied it at the end. But of course, you know, what kind of country is he in to speak truthfully about that? Or whether there was some love triangle at one of the Soviet officials sort of had competition with him over a woman, or whether he said something that was very un-PC, you know, at that time. So he was kind of a legend in Magadan. Again, when I was young, I wasn't quite aware of him. I did go to a concert in his honor.
A three-hour concert. Was it really 3 hours?
Well, I think it was longer than that, to which he didn't show up. But, you know, I don't remember anything about it, about the concert, what's in the story. I made it all up. But I do remember, actually, my grandfather telling me a story. He was his neighbor. I mean, they didn't interact at all in mm-hmm. real life. But he's passed him sometimes on the flight stairs. So I was writing the story, and I wanted to give him more life. But then I realized I didn't want to use the actual person because, again, I'm just adding to the rumors, right? Because, as you said, he yet again doesn't have a voice in the story, and he sort of never will. And that's part of the tragedy. And it becomes the story like, you know, the grandfather character is looking over his life and what is his angle. And just he is not aware just how different it is, like how his experience is just one of the several that you could have during the Soviet Union, and how you can be so successful next to a person whose life is so tragic, and, you know, they're denied a love and they're denied a voice at the end of it.
Well, you know what's really wonderful about that story and about all your stories really is that they're about something, mm-hmm. but really they're about the character's desire. There's mm-hmm. something always underneath. There's like these parallel narratives that are going on at the same time, so that every detail
at least two.
Has multiple
I usually try to put it like,
and I think mm-hmm. good stories are yeah. about more than one thing. And it's really lovely that you've been able to give voice to people who have not been heard. And thank you for being on our show. It's been lovely.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hi, I'm Sam Calvin Brown. I'm a student in the UTEP Bilingual MFA in Creative Writing, and I'm going to read And Death Shall Have No Dominion by Dylan Thomas. And death shall have no dominion. Dead men naked, they shall be one with the man in the wind and the west moon. When their bones are picked clean, and the clean bones gone, they shall have stars at elbow and foot. Though they go mad, they shall be sane. Though they sink to the sea, they shall rise again. Though lovers be lost, love shall not, and death shall have no dominion. And death shall have no dominion. Under the windings of the sea, they lying long shall not die windily. Twisting on racks when sinews give way, strapped to a wheel, yet they shall not break. Faith in their hands shall snap in two, and the unicorn evils run them through. Split all ends up, they shan't crack, and death shall have no dominion. And death shall have no dominion. No more may gulls cry at their ears, or waves break loud on the seashores. Where blew a flower no more lift its head to the blows of the rain. Though they be mad and dead as nails, heads of the characters hammer through daisies, break in the sun till the sun breaks down, and death shall have no dominion. I'm Sam Calvin Brown, and that was And Death Shall Have No Dominion by Dylan Thomas.
This is Azucena Dominguez, and I'm a retired mathematics teacher from the area. I taught for 36 years, and I've been writing for a while now. I belong to Tumblewords Writing Project, and I've done a few poetry readings around the area, and I've actually done 3 open mics, which were quite exciting for me. This story is mainly about my brother. I was 7 and he was 11, and we had lost our mom that year. My brother, my hero. We used to go up in the mountains and pick up pine nuts, or piñones, called in Spanish, when we were little. Sometimes we had a container, and other times we used our blouse or t-shirt to hold them. I personally loved the pine trees, as they looked like Christmas trees to me. They looked even more beautiful with snow on them. The hard part picking the pine nuts was not to get any of that sticky sap, or trementina, as we called it. Also, it was easy if the pine cones were opened, and my dad or brother would shake the tree, and all the pine nuts would fall on the ground. We would go as a family, but other times, my brother and I would go after school. Since he was the only boy in the family, I would play with him all the time. One day, he and I went up to the mountains to pick up piñones, not too far from home, but I was wearing sandals, so it was hard to walk because of the rugged trails and so many rocks. We found a pine tree that had so many pine cones, so we decided to try and pick as many pine nuts as we could. As I was walking towards the trunk of the tree, there was a broken bottle that I didn't see. I stepped on it, and it literally scooped out a chunk of meat from my foot. Instantly, blood started spurting out, and I started screaming in pain. The first thing that my brother did was take off his shirt and wrap it around my foot and put some pressure to try to stop the bleeding. I could not stop crying, and seeing all the blood was making me woozy. My brother lifted me on his back, and we went down the mountain as he carried me piggyback all the way home. My brother's shirt on my foot was soaking with blood when we got home, and I was feeling faint. Thankfully, my father was home, so he cleaned my wound right away. It was so deep that you could see the bone, and it looked like a crater. My dad used some Mexican medications, mercurochromo and sulfatiazol powder, and bandaged my foot. Every morning and every evening, he would tend to my wound. And it healed well, although it left a scar that looked almost like an eye. My father was mad at my brother because he thought my brother was careless and should not have taken me up to the rocky mountainous area, especially since I was wearing sandals. I thought my brother was a hero and had saved my life that day. For Words on a Wire, this is Azucena Dominguez.
I'd like to thank our guest, Ksenia Melnick, for joining us for Words on a Wire. It's good to know that there's other writers living in El Paso. You know, for a city of its size, El Paso has a lot of good writers. I mean, excellent writers. There's me and, well, others. But she's a fantastic writer. It's a great book. Please pick it up. And I'd like to thank my co-host, Benjamin Alida Sainz, for joining us for the interview. I'm also going to introduce another co-host in the next few weeks, a guy named Timzy Hernandez, who you know. He's been on our show 3 or 4 times. And now that he's a professor here at UTEP, we're going to co-host some shows together. I'll do some by myself. He'll do some by himself. But I think he's going to be a great addition to Words on a Wire. Actually, the first show that we have him on, it's going to be like a job interview. And if he's good, we're going to let him do the job. If he's bad, we're going to say, sorry, Tim, you're out. I'm Daniel Chacon. Join me every week for Words on a Wire. And don't forget, the next book you read may save your soul.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tightrope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubber neck giraffe, you look